Hi, Patrick here with one of those long podcasts that several of you have been asking for. Cartoon Queen, Carol Hills, and I are picking out a few language-related stories that kind of made it into the news without hitting the front pages. They didn't exactly become BuzzFeed clickbait. We're going to try and do something about that. So get ready for somewhat inexpert talk about how babies acquire language, in some cases more than one language. Also, language politics in the Balkans. The near universality of the word, huh. The near universality of the word, sorry, in almost every sentence in some cultures. And the unintended consequences of the endangered languages movement. Here goes. Carol, it's been way too long, as usual. I always say this, but it has been too long.
It's been a really long time.
Well, it's great to have you back here again. And 2014, all these words have been chosen as words of the year by all of these dictionaries and societies and all of that. And,
I know, it's exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Olympics are coming up. I'm excited. Yeah.
Well, we're going to do five stories today that have been in the news, but not that much in the news. I'll start off, and this is a nice one. This popped up about a month ago. There were a series of opinion pieces and blog posts and the like about the word sorry, about apologies. I guess we'd reached some kind of tipping point. People had just had enough of apologies. And I kind of understood why. I mean, here's a pretty well-known apology from recent times.
To the residents of Toronto, I know I have let you down. And I can't do anything else but apologize. I apologize. And I'm so sorry.
That, of course, is Toronto Mayor Rob Ford saying sorry for smoking crack and sorry for then lying about the fact that he smoked crack for denying it. And in fact, he is so sorry that he is not only not resigning, but he's announced he's filed papers to run for re-election later on this year.
Did he say he was sorry for not resigning?
I didn't catch that, sorry. He was contrite in that very controlled way, even with a sort of quiver in his voice, always with a view, it seemed to me, you know, the classic political apology, always with a view to, you know, what's his next political move.
Yes.
But there are many, many other categories of apology, and I think this is what people who've been writing these blog posts have been objecting to. And I, as a Brit, I think that, you know, we Brits, we really specialize in apologies.
But you often say it in a way that means you're not sorry. But you are completely, and there's that one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The I'm sorry, but that drives me crazy because I get an awful lot of that on Twitter. You know, I'll put out something, maybe I'll link to an article that I kind of like and I'll say, oh, I like it. And then somebody will write back to me and say, I'm sorry, but, and then they'll say the whole central point of this article is absurd and crazy and what was I even thinking, linking to it and sort of semi-endorsing it. I have no problem in somebody pointing out the error of my ways.
Why do they have to say they're sorry first? Why don't they just say it?
Yeah, I do have a problem with them apologizing for doing so. I'd be more than happy to otherwise accept the suggesting that I got it wrong. So, yeah, that's one big category. Then there is, go back to the old British thing. This is something that probably doesn't come up in this country as much as it does in Britain. Maybe it comes up in other places. But I came across another blog post. I was on the lookout for them after a while. There was one in Esquire by an American based in Britain. He's in the military. He's a lieutenant colonel, Robert Bateman.
As you would say, lieutenant.
As we indeed would say. Or I might once have said lieutenant.
That lieutenant is just so wrong. But anyway, go ahead.
I wish we had the man himself in here to ask him maybe, well, you know, when he's confronted, would be called lieutenant.
It's like calling right tenant. It's not. It's just stop it.
You know, maybe he's a liberal. I don't know. Anyway, I think he hit the nail on the head. I'm just going to read out the segment of his post that deals with this. He said he describes sorry as the single most popular word in the United Kingdom. Here's what he says. Seriously, I have never seen nor heard of a more apologetic people. They use this word constantly and completely unnecessarily, like some cultural touchstone which makes people forgive them for once conquering the better part of the planet and calling it their own. Walk past a Brit in a corridor that requires both of you to make a slight quarter turn to comfortably pass, and they will say, sorry. Approach a doorway, and they will wait, holding it for you, for a crazy long time, and then they will say, sorry.
Sorry for holding the door for you?
For holding the door. They're holding the door for you. It's true, though. This guy's got it.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know how that is.
Is it just some sort of nervous reflex?
I think that is exactly that. And that brings us on, actually, to the Japanese, because the Japanese have a word for sorry, which works rather like the British English version of sorry, insofar as it means excuse me, as well as sorry. And insofar, it is what you just said, a kind of nervous tick. It's as someone described it in one article I read, as a sort of, as a placeholder sound, something like that. The word is, sorry about the usual pronunciation, apologies. The word is sumimasen, something like that. Anyway, it has that kind of catch-all feel to it. And you just say, if in doubt, say that.
Sumimasen.
So there you go. You're well on your way in Japan. You're well on your way in Britain. I guess the Canadians, too, Rob Ford included, they've got a bit of a
reputation. They're big on sorry, which they say sorry.
Uh-huh.
Our colleague, Andrea Crossan, said she's Canadian. When she first moved to London, she kept bumping into people on the tube and kept saying, sorry, sorry. And then she realized it was ridiculous. So she just stopped. And now she has contempt for Canadians who say sorry.
That's interesting.
Sorry.
So Canadians,
they sort of say it like that. Like, sorry, excuse me.
Well, I'd like to see who would win the sorry contest among Canadians, Brits, and Japanese. I think it sounds like it would be a pretty close-run thing. The Chinese, on the other hand, now I know this because I'm married into a Chinese-American family and also because I'm learning Chinese. You do not say sorry unless you've done something wrong. There's basically a whole bunch of other things that you can say in Chinese that make an awful lot more sense, which to me makes sense. And I must admit, I'm there with Andrea, our Canadian colleague, and with you and the American usage. It's clearly a word that is overused by certain
people. Is the sense that you're finding among on Twitter is that people think it's increased and is therefore a problem, or has it been around and they're just sick of it?
I think it has increased. And it's increased in this kind of unpleasant, aggressive way where people are doing everything but apologizing. And this is, I think, the case for a huge number of these categories, is that they're using the word sorry to actually avoid truly apologizing. So if I say sorry, then I don't really have to apologize. You know, there is a further category that we haven't spoken about yet, which is almost the I'm sorry if I offended anyone. I'm sorry if I caused distress to someone. The implication there is that someone may be oversensitive. The problem is with them, it's not with you.
I think online life has really contributed to this because there's so much more back and forth in conversation and potential ways to offend people. You know, it's everywhere.
And you're not physically present with the people with whom you're having these interactions. And that doesn't help either, because once you've got body language, once you've got eye contact, all of those things, there's all kinds of other ways in which to convey empathy and all of those other things.
I mean, it's the old saw that most of what's said online or, you know, in a letter or whatever, you wouldn't say it if you were sitting next to the person.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, Patrick, but I think...
Carol, that's okay. Let's go on to the next story.
Huh? My topic, this next topic is, huh? And even the way I'm saying it, the inflection is part of the story. Huh?
Mm.
You know, kind of, going up, huh?
Oh.
What's interesting is that there's this almost impossible to read language study. I don't know, these people, these linguistics people, they may be into language, but wow, writing is another thing. Whew! God, it took a machete to get through this stuff. But anyway, they wanted to determine, they did a study that they feel helps to prove that huh is a word, not only a word, but a word that exists really across languages. You know, they studied like 31 languages maybe originally 50 and they discarded some for certain reasons across all continents where there are human beings living anyway. And they found a consistent pattern of the use of huh. And it's not phonetically identical, but its use is. Basically, the study was trying to prove two things, that huh is universal and that it's a word as opposed to like a grunt. Well,
what makes it different from the word what?
It is what they call, Patrick, a repair initiator in the language of linguistics, meaning across all these languages, people say huh or something like it. There's three parts. You say something to me, I don't understand it or something, I go huh? And that word itself conveys, you said something, I don't understand it, please tell me what you really meant. That it prompts you to then re-say it or explain what's going on. And that sequence seems to exist across languages, from a tiny language in Ecuador to, you know, Japanese to English, across the board.
Always monosyllabic.
Yes. Never ends in a consonant, monosyllabic. And even they got down to where the tongue is in your mouth, that your lips are going to be round, the position of your tongue, how high it goes and where it lands on that upper part. I don't remember the name of that. But so it's interesting. And they collected recordings from all over the world. They listened to them. And is there. There's a couple languages where it doesn't go up like, huh? It goes down. Oh. Only like two, Icelandic and this small language in Ecuador. Hmm. But all the rest is like, huh? It goes up. And it's sort of prompting a response of clarifying something.
Wow, that sounds very Chomskyan, doesn't it?
It is very Chomskyan. Yes, universalist. And, you know, it's interesting. They think that, huh, may have started out as a grunt, you know.
It still is, as far as I can tell.
You know, I mean, of course, right. They don't know. You can't go back and listen to human speech, you know. But they think it may have began as a grunt. But as language evolved, and it seems to have done so across all these language groups, it evolved to have a function. All these words are just impossible to understand.
I've probably always meant, like, what the hell are you talking about? in the early years, before language was particularly sophisticated, there was probably an awful lot of misunderstanding. No wonder.
But somehow it's, you know, there may have been other grunts that didn't end on an uptick where they were going, you know, like, that tastes good. Or there was, you know, go away.
Right.
Then there's, huh? And then eventually it morphs into, huh?
How far we've come.
But let me just give you a taste, just a taste of how this thing is written. It's always sort of ironic, you know, it's about language, but you can't even understand it.
Well, let me this study, huh?
Here's one of the conclusions. Huh? Is thus an item integrated in several linguistic subsystems from segmental and prosodic phonology to conversational structure. Now, what the hell does that mean?
Carol, you and I are here to popularize these studies.
So I can't just make
fun
of it.
Bring these to the people. So what you're telling me is that you have been reading a study that you don't understand, and now you're talking on a podcast.
Exactly. And then I read the summation in it, you know, the sort of article that somebody writes to summarize the story. But it is interesting. The basic thing is, the key thing about huh is that it's universal. It seems to be universal across languages. Not a grunt, has a specific role, and it's a word. So it's one of the few. I mean, I think that nobody's found another universal word in a language. Because if you think about it, like dog.
What about Coca-Cola?
It's brand, baby. But
someone needs to turn huh into a brand.
I mean, if 1,300 years ago they'd been, you know, ways of branding, maybe. But what the study is careful to say is that, yes, languages respond to their environment. And as we know, there's lots of languages. They sound vastly different from one another. And a word describing the same thing across languages can be completely different. You know, dog, chien, hund, whatever. You know, they're all different. But huh is something universal. I mean, it may differ a little bit, like but it's a word. And it's said in a sequence of prompts. Mm. And so it's kind of cool.
Huh.
Huh.
I suppose that's a slightly different way of saying huh, isn't it? It's like a,
but you're,
oh, that's interesting.
But you're saying, huh, oh, I get it. Yeah. If you said, huh, I'd have to say, well, Patrick, it means.
Right.
But what it doesn't get into is when people, what happens when people say, huh, and then the, it doesn't prompt. The other person just ignores them or walks away.
Well, that may well happen in some cultures.
But I think it's an interesting story.
Mm.
Don't read the studies. Go right to the synopsis. Don't go to primary sources. Go straight to the digest.
That's what we journalists do. Trust us. Okay. All right. Well, let's move right along then to the next story. This is a sad story because it's about how people use language. It's an extreme example of people using language for political ends. Well, this is taking place in the former Yugoslavia and Bosnia, and I've been there as well, and I think as a result it means a little bit more to me. I love the place, but in Bosnia after the war, the price that was paid for the fighting to end was that the country was divided. It was centrally weak and divided into segments, roughly one half being Bosnian Serb and roughly the other half run by ethnic Croats and Muslims, also known as Bosniaks. And then within the Muslim Croat Federation, there was this division itself, which all whittled on down to the very local levels and how kids were taught in the schools. The language, which used to be called Serbo-Croatian, in fact, it was called Serbo-Croatian by one of the Brothers Grimm, you know, the Jakob Grimm,
really?
Who was a philologist. He was a linguist, and he was the person who originally called the language of the Southern Slavs Serbo-Croatian. So here's what was one language and what is considered still by many linguists to be one language that is only linguistically separated in dialects, regional dialects. It is nonetheless referred to now as Serbian, Croatian, and Bosnian, and for that matter, actually Montenegrin as well, down in the what is now the country of Montenegro, as if, you know, attempts at nation building and identity building and all of this really got nothing to, you know, very little to do with the language.
But in reality, how different are the languages?
They're mutually intelligible, even actually beyond that, with some of the other languages of the former Yugoslavia. Slovene is mutually intelligible with a dialect of Serbian that's spoken near the Slovene border. Macedonian, likewise, it's partially intelligible with Serbian, although it is much closer to modern-day Bulgarian. In Bosnia, you just have these three so-called languages, which are essentially dialects that have been strengthened since the end of the fighting because it has been politically expedient for the leaders to try and separate these languages out and insist, you know, on more and more difference, whereas really they only have dialectical difference. Those languages are each of them taught in the schools to the ethnic groups concerned. So if you have a majority Serbian bunch of kids, then they're taught in Serbian. If there is a significant minority, then that minority have to be accommodated and taught in their own language. The problem is when there is not a significant minority of kids, and then those kids don't get to be taught in their mother dialect / tongue / language. And so there's a situation in the Serbian Republic right now of Bosnian Muslim minority kids in small numbers being taught in Serbian. So they're taught.
And you're talking
this
about, when you say the Serbian Republic, this is within Bosnia.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the Serbian portion of Bosnia. And so you have these Bosnian Muslim kids that are not being taught in the dialect that they speak at home. Probably not a huge problem in and of itself because the languages are mutually intelligible. Where it does become a problem is they're taught history and civics and all those kinds of things with a Serbian slant. And so it kind of carries over. The language is just the beginning of a much greater set of issues on the curriculum.
So within their curriculum, being taught in their own language, you know, that's the only sort of political thing they have in their favor going for them. And so if they lose that, then they're basically getting a Serbian education.
Yeah, exactly. And the parents of some of these kids have started making a fuss about this, refusing to enroll their kids in the Serbian-dominated schools and there's a bit of a standoff right now, and this is the latest thing for the international authorities, who are still in large part enforcing certain parts of the Bosnian constitution because there's no real strong central authority. This is the latest headache for them to deal with. It's very sad because it feels, as ever in that part of the world, that politicians and nationalist politicians are kind of holding everybody else hostage, in this case, kids, families, what have you. It may not sound like a big deal to us English speakers because we're completely used to a huge variety in the English language. You know, what do we care? But there, it matters. Boy, does it matter. But unfortunately, this has been the history.
How could it be sorted out easily? Providing the language instruction or having everybody, since you're living in the same country, be taught in the same language?
Yeah, I suppose the American solution might be busing, which might involve taking kids across, and I don't know, I must confess, I have no idea how much this already goes on in Bosnia, but it could involve busing people from one valley to the next. It could involve busing them across the internal line between the Republika Srpska, the Serbian part of Bosnia, across to the Muslim Croat Federation. Now, how practical that is on a daily basis in a mountainous place with, you know, not the most fabulous transportation infrastructure, I don't know. Okay, so on to next story. What you got for us, Carol?
My next story is about babbling babies. Kind of related to huh, but younger. I'm sure babies say huh, too, but they say other things first. Blah, 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 you know. So I bet you they say huh a lot, even if they don't say it. They just sit there and just think, what? What is going on?
Yeah, and then they burst into tears because you can't understand that they're saying huh.
Because you can't, and you don't know that it's the repair blah blah, whatever they called it in linguistics study. So this study that I'm not sure I buy it. Researchers at University of Washington, University of Connecticut, they examined all these snippets of sound from babies. They recorded all these babies. To me, the image is so funny. The babies wore vests with recording equipment on them that would record them as they babbled.
That's kind of cute.
I know. Basically, they were listening to how the babies were interacting with their parents. And these babies were about 1 year old. There are 26 of them. So they do this from basically 1 year to 2 years old. Then here's the key part. The parents fill out a questionnaire about how many words the babies learned. That, to me, is a big flaw in this study.
Oh, yeah, that's a red flag. The lying that goes on among parents how much their babies have accomplished.
So the goal of the study was to figure out, is there certain kinds of ways parents should communicate with their babies that will enhance the baby's acquisition of language and understanding? Mm. And what they were comparing was basically talking to your kids, because everyone's told you should talk to your kids. Babies.
Good
talk
idea.
To them from their I mean, not just around them, but talk to them. Mm. And, you know, a lot of people haven't known that, you know, but people should talk to their babies, even if they're, you know, barely a couple days old. They talk and talk and talk. But what the study was finding is that there's a certain way to talk to your kid that may encourage more language acquisition and understanding earlier, which is baby talk. So like, oh, look at the ball. Oh, did you eat your dinner? And all that, just, oh, you know, those things.
Kind of the irritating stuff.
The really irritating stuff. Yeah. So they say that's more effective.
Great.
But who's determining? The parents themselves are filling out the forms about what words their kids have learned.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not clear to me in what I read about the study that the study people conducting the study are somehow checking these lists against the recordings from the baby vests. So,
well, but I suppose just to argue the other side, I mean, it does make sense that if you do the goo-goo-ga-ga a little bit, even if the baby is sort of like, well, what's with a goo-goo-ga-ga, drop it. But the baby knows that you're talking to him or her, right?
I mean, the baby
it's
has a
quite clear that you're totally focused on him or her. Whereas if you just sort of stood over the baby and said, you know, right now, Johnny, drink your milk or something like that, it just doesn't sound necessarily as intimate or as personable I don't know. Even if you're kind of looking it in the eye.
Because I think what's so much of it about is the parent, you know, the kid sees the parent. The parent is looking at them with their eyes.
Yeah.
And so much, I'm just assuming, of early interaction between a parent and a child is, you know, the parent is mooning over the baby.
Yeah.
And the baby does something and the parent responds.
Yeah.
What they say is that in the study, you know, the two-year-olds whose families spoke the most baby talk on the one-on-one situations knew 433 words on average compared with 169 words recognized by two-year-olds and families where the least baby talk and the least one-on-one.
Yeah.
So it seems like the point of the story is, yes, everybody keep talking to your babies. It's important. It's really important. And don't just park them in a high chair and cook your dinner.
I think I buy that, although I share your skepticism about, you know, whether it's just the verbals. But it does seem as though, you know, I mean, my daughter's first words were ball. Now, they were ball not because she was obsessed with balls. I mean, she liked balls and everything, but the World Cup was on at the time. And I was obsessed with, let's face it, I was obsessed with balls at the time. So balls entered my conversation a huge amount of the time. It was on the TV. I was throwing them around. I was kicking them. They were everywhere, right? So my daughter was picking up what I was into.
Yeah.
And I was trying to make her interested in that. And so there was definitely, I passed on that word. And that must have happened subsequently with a whole bunch of other words.
You know what my daughter's first word was?
What was
our
that?
Kids are about the same age.
Yeah.
Mine. Mine.
We should have put the two of them together. Ball. Mine.
Mine. Mine. It's still quite a popular word.
Oh,
her.
I bet it is. Yeah.
And I keep thinking back, what were we saying?
What was the next one? No.
I think it was because, you know, she has an older brother. Mine. And I wanted to mention one other language study that I read briefly a synopsis of, which is it's a New Zealand study that seems to suggest that babies not only understand language when they're young and pick up language, but they understand when different languages are spoken.
What, when they have, like, parents who speak two different languages or something?
Well, they kind of set up the experiment. So a kid observes, you know, these are infants, and the parents may be engaging in baby ease, are identifying things. So the kid, you know,
right,
doll
right.
or food or whatever. Yeah. And so they can tell when somebody comes in and they maybe point to the same object, they use a different word. I think what they're suggesting is the baby doesn't, it's not like the baby says, oh, they're speaking German, not English. It's just the baby knows. The baby knows that it's not the same word.
So the theory is that those two sets of channels that I can't remember exactly what the people who study bilingualism talk about, but two channels in the brain that work separately with different languages are being set up at this early stage. What age is it?
As young as 13 months.
13 months. Yeah, that is young.
Yeah. They seem to have found that infants, this is a quote here, appreciate that words are not shared by speakers of different languages, suggesting that infants have a fairly nuanced understanding of the conventional nature of language. Basically, it's sort of saying, you know, people think babies absorb language, you don't have to teach them, but they actually do. They're not learning abstractly. They are assigning words to things. They are picking up specifics. That's what it seems to be saying.
That's very interesting. We've heard again and again, you know, about how language acquisition starts, you know, in the womb and all of this. And so I guess it would make sense that dual language acquisition would also start at a very young age.
Yes.
That's fascinating. It would be interesting to see some more studies around that one. Okay, so Carol, last story. And this is actually, there's kind of two stories here, because here's the story that I was going to do that I nearly did, but there was then a change in the story that made me not do it. So in a sneaky way, I'm not going to talk about this story, which is there's a small village in Wales called Vartec. And in Wales at the moment, with the Welsh language movement and
the land
Welsh,
of consonants.
Yeah, and the land of consonants, all of that. Anyway, because Welsh is gaining official status sort of bit by bit in Wales, one of the things that's taking place is a lot of small communities are being renamed. They sort of have Welsh names, but they're not properly spelled, and, you know, it's just a kind of a mess. So they were going to change this village called Varteg, V-A-R-T-E-G. They were going to change the V to the correct Welsh spelling, which would be an F.
I know where you're going.
You know where I'm going. Let me tell you why they didn't. I actually just quote from, let's see, his name is Richard Clark. He is a councillor of the local region. This is what he said. Whilst we in Wales understand the pronunciation, outsiders will call it fart egg. And they will bring the area into disrepute and the residents with it. And so therefore the village of Varteg remains Varteg or Varteg or I don't know how you
just have
it.
A lot of, you know, 10-year-old boys visiting.
Yeah, and stealing the signs. I think that's another thing that takes place. And it is costly. So anyway, that's the story I'm not going to talk about.
But that's in some ways it's an interesting language story because they know it's the right thing to change it to F.
Yes.
But because of external things, they are keeping it.
That's right.
And therefore, historians hundreds and hundreds of years from now will look back, why wasn't the V changed to F?
Well, I think Welsh language diehards will say it's all the fault of English because,
of course,
you know, if the English language wasn't there and if people weren't speaking English, nobody would be able to make that joke.
That's right.
Yep. Okay, well, on to the real story that I want to talk about, which is it concerns the endangered languages movement. Now, this is a movement that sometime in the 1990s, a lot of linguists realized that languages were dying at a rate of knots. And again, as a result of something like
rate
English.
Rate of knots, what is that?
Fast.
Okay.
Super fast. That's probably some nautical expression.
Yeah. Yeah.
Knots. Anyway, they were disappearing the rate that is usually cited, and I have no idea if it's still accurate or ever was, is one every 2 weeks. In any case, a movement sort of arose out of this in which linguists and especially young doctoral students, etc., in large numbers started going out into the field and documenting endangered languages, the idea being that you kind of capture something of it before it vanished because they were vanishing so fast and you just wanted to hang on to a piece of it before it disappeared, partly in order to almost do a service to the speakers or the descendants of the speakers of that language. So there would be sort of something they could hang on to culturally. Yeah. And that has certainly taken place quite successfully with several Native American languages here. But also there was a widespread belief, and the remains, I believe, a belief that each language contains something unique about human experience. And so when that language goes, that unique piece of human experience also goes. And so therefore, the richness of our lives is somehow being chipped away every time one of these languages goes. So, you know, again, that was maybe a kind of non-linguistic impulse, but nonetheless, this is something that is cited an awful lot. The third reason was more to do with just how each language works. And although there is back and forth among the linguistic community as to sort of how universal languages are and how much they follow essentially the same pattern, the same sort of meta pattern, there are many, many variations among languages and that it's worth studying those variations to figure out how language works in a more general sort of way. So, you know, for all of those reasons, these endangered languages were studied. Along comes a guy called Paul Newman. He's a professor emeritus from Indiana University. He's a Hausa specialist, a Hausa, the language of Nigeria, or a language of Nigeria. And he's had an interesting history with endangered languages. He was one of the people who never believed that an endangered language movement would actually get started. And he's since pointed out that he was wrong in thinking that. He underestimated the interest in endangered languages. He was recently invited to SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, which has its own endangered languages unit where there's a number of people who study endangered languages, one of the best known in the world. And they invited him because I think they wanted him to, and they knew that he had some skepticism about this area of research, and they wanted him to lay it out. And it's kind of great that they actually invited the enemy, as it were, to come and talk to them. And he then laid out his critique of what endangered languages study is doing to the field of linguistics in general. And let's just play a little bit of what he had to say when he went there.
The endangered languages movement has spawned what I consider to be unsound practices and ideas that in just a brief period of time have become increasingly entrenched in the field. These errors can be grouped into three categories, namely, what language to study, 2, what aspect of a language should one study, and 3, methodologically, how should one go about doing field research.
So basically he's saying that all of these people studying endangered languages are studying the wrong languages. They're not necessarily studying the languages that tell linguists the most about how languages work. And in doing so, they're using the wrong methods. They're using this approach of what is disparagingly described as documentary linguistics, that they're simply documenting and gathering rather than analyzing. And then they're archiving this material, again, with the worthy intention of ensuring that these languages have some sort of life beyond their spoken life. Newman describes these archives as linguistic graveyards, places where the material goes unanalyzed, just simply sits there. And I mean, basically, he thinks it's a waste of time. He thinks, you know, there's so much to learn about language that people in the field of linguistics just shouldn't be doing this kind of stuff. That they should.
He basically thinks it's kind of a sort of gathering material and data collecting, but there's no real analysis.
Yeah, it's kind of like uber worthy and not much else. And he's just worried that as a result of this, there's just going to be this black hole of research, that the endangered language movement, however long it lasts, is just going to be this period in the history of linguistics research that doesn't produce very much at all.
So his preferred approach appears to be kind of from above. People should decide what are the languages that are worth looking at and examine some specific aspect of those languages, as opposed to just collecting a treasure of words and phrases and structure and going no further with it.
Yeah, and I think also there's the implicit belief that if you're studying a living language, a language that is still widely spoken, as he does, you're studying a language that is still in evolution. And that's inherently more interesting than studying a language that is no longer spoken or is about to die out. It's going to make it an awful lot more difficult to figure out the evolution of that language. There's less to go on, and so therefore the conclusions you draw are not going to be as broad as otherwise you could do with a living language.
I'm curious what sort of response he got when he gave this speech.
I don't have a huge amount to go by there. I've only seen a video of it. Below the black line notes on the blog post, there were certainly some criticisms of his approach, and people criticized the fact that they thought he was sort of overlooking the analysis and research aspect of what was taking place. There's a couple of things here. You're not only documenting, you're also doing some sort of in the field and on the ground analysis there and then. But also, if you're documenting this stuff, there's nothing to stop people in the future from analyzing this. You can't analyze anything if you don't have the documentary evidence to start off with.
And I imagine it's also a foul of the money. There's probably grant money. It became a sexy topic, endangered languages, and there's grant money associated with it so linguists can apply. It's something that is popular.
Well, yeah, and I think that that is something that really concerns him, is that with all of these fields, it's always about the money, right? So if the money's going there, it's not going somewhere else. And you probably cannot raise a lot of money if you want to do something on something less sexy and obscure that doesn't involve, you know, people who are having their language taken away. I mean, that's a kind of a dramatic thing. But if you want to study something about, you know, something very narrow about syntax in, I don't know, 19th century German or something like that, it just may not.
That will not be sexy.
No. So,
you know, as a radio person, I immediately thought, well, when they're collecting and documenting, are they also recording? So are they trying to record so we know what things sound like?
Yeah. There's an awful lot of that going on. And there's the movie, The Linguists, in which it is documented how they document. So, and that's, they take 3, 4, 5 examples of some of their field work and how they make contact with the people who are speaking these languages and how they gain the confidence of those people and then document the language and archive it. I mean, it seems to me that there's got to be room for that. It
yes.
seems that, especially given that we're at this time of sort of globalization and anglicization, in which English and a couple of other big languages is just running roughshod over all of these other languages, it would seem absurd to just turn your back on these disappearing languages and just not try and collect as much as possible from them, even the ones that clearly are half dead.
But I guess the larger issue is it affecting the whole field? Is the field becoming a field of collecting and documenting as opposed to analysis? And maybe there's room for both, but
I think it would be good to do a story on that. I'd like to do a story on this where I talk to a lot of different people with a lot of different points of view. One conclusion might be that we're in a time of crisis and that research may have to take a back seat to documentation for a while.
Because one of the key challenges of linguistics is the fact that, particularly for the sound of languages, you can't go back very far and know what things sounded like.
That's right.
And so there's obviously, if you can document it now, there's reason to do that.
Right.
I guess a larger question. In some ways, the field of linguistics is going to find out as it goes along. Some of these things, they can't be predetermined.
Yeah. I mean, if linguistics people are just doing this for their own sake and for their own careers rather than for the sake of anything else, then clearly there's a problem. But I think in most cases, that's probably not the case. Yeah. But I do think that this is a discussion worth having. And I think it's great that SOAS invited one of their critics to come and pose some of these questions.
I do too.
Well, Carol, thank you very much. This was a great discussion.
Thank you, Patrick.
Tell us just before you go, what's happening in the cartoon world?
A lot of cartoons about the upcoming Olympics in Sochi. You know, cartoons on weather. How secure is it? You know, Trojan horses coming into Sochi and that kind of thing, particularly after those suicide bombs. Always cartoons about fledgling peace efforts between Arabs and Israelis.
Yeah, where there's hypocrisy, there's
a cartoonist. And even if there isn't hypocrisy, the cartoonist will find some.
Because cartoons. I'll post a link to Carol's cartoon enterprise and also to all the stories that we discussed today. That'll be at pri.org/language. See you on Facebook at the World in Words page or on Twitter, where I tweet as Patry Cox, PatriCox. Thanks for listening. I'll be back soon.